Hello and welcome to Late Night Live with me, Norman Swan, sitting in for Philip Adams. Two absolutely fascinating topics and discussions for you tonight. You're going to hear about the Tribal Patriarchy Index, a fairly simple measure of a community which predicts oppression of and violence to women. Now, while you might think of Afghanistan or Somalia or even Islam, could some of our suburbs score uncomfortably high in the index and among people of other religions such as Judaism or Christianity? And whether the term asylum seeker has actually been redundant for some years and the UN Convention on Refugees hopelessly out of date, and maybe we need to reconceptualise migration. And perhaps too little has changed for 50 or even 100 years. It's a week where a regional agreement was made, the Jakarta Declaration on Asylum Seekers, albeit a fairly loose sort of agreement, and where more lives have been lost in yet another boat off Christmas Island. So maybe it is time for a complete rethink on border control as well. And perhaps it's time we stop talking in terms of legal and illegal refugees versus economic migrants. Jeremy Harding points out that there are many, many reasons for what he calls clandestine migration. Jeremy's been writing about migration for many years. He's a journalist, a contributing editor at the London Review of Books, and is in Australia as the guest of the Melbourne Writers' Festival. Welcome to Late Night Live, Jeremy.
Thanks very much, Norman. Good to be here.
You've just arrived, you know, we're in the middle of an election campaign. We've got this thing on the ABC called Vote Compass. 800,000 Australians have registered their views and filled out the Vote Compass. And the asylum seeker issue is number two on their list. Does that surprise you?
It doesn't surprise me, especially in view of the fact that you're, you know, on the edge of an election. Asylum and migration are big, big issues in Europe, and they tend to intensify as countries approach an election. This is a very important issue, and unfortunately it's one from which politicians can make quite a bit of hay. So I'm hoping here, without knowing Australia well, that the politicians are doing it responsibly. But tell me about the Compass findings. I mean, how were people split on that?
Well, they were split, I should really dig out the paper here, but the I mean, it was across the board. I mean, Labour voters as well as Conservative voters.
Right.
They supported opposition leaders Tony Abbott's campaign pledge to turn back the boats, but it does strongly divide Australians along ideological lines. Prime Minister Kevin Rudd's pre-election shift on asylum seeker policy, the Papua New Guinea solution, has divided Labour supporters. Green supporters are more likely than any other party to support more immigrants coming to Australia. And older Australians are far more likely than younger voters to believe restrictions on work visas for foreigners should be tightened.
Yeah, and on asylum, if I remember from glancing at it this morning, it's pretty much 50-50, isn't it, on the issue of people arriving by boat, the notion of trying to put an end to that and close down right of asylum is something that divides the electorate, or at least this sample, more or less evenly.
And not unique to Australia?
Absolutely not. I mean, in Europe, which is the place I know best on this, there are many, the division is, you know, pretty even, really. People believe in the right of asylum, and others believe that maybe there are just too many commitments that we've undertaken in the EU and as signatories to the convention. But I think this split is, I'm fascinated by the split in Australia, because I was under the impression before I came here that the boats issue was something that really overwhelmingly people were worried by, anxious about. Okay, the anxiety is clear, whether you're in favour of asylum, giving it to people who arrive by boat or not. But actually, there seems to be quite a lot of support for the idea that people who do arrive under whatever circumstances have a right to asylum, as the 1951 Geneva Convention stipulates.
Now, you've recently updated a book that you wrote several years ago, really in the 90s, and the new title is called Border Vigils, Keeping Migrants Out of the Rich World. And there's some really vivid images in that book. One is of you being on an Italian customs boat, I suppose a border boat.
Yes.
Chasing high-powered inflatables coming across from Albania in an almost futile attempt to stop the tens of thousands of unauthorized migrants coming across that 90-kilometer piece of water.
Yeah, absolutely. This was in the 1990s. And I'd reported on the war in the Balkans, the war in Kosovo, and I was very, very struck by the number of people that had been displaced. And I worked later with the Italian government, the immigration side, because it was coming across from Albania that was the route many people took to get to safety. And actually what was going on across that stretch of water was basically a ritual game. The marine police were obliged to give pursuit to these rafts, but they're anything between 300 or 400 people would be landed every night. They'd be processed, they'd be fingerprinted, they'd go for interviews, and then they'd be...
And they'd be set free.
Eventually, in due course, they'd be set free, and some would make claims for asylum in Italy, and some, in spite of the rule of the Dublin Convention, wouldn't make a claim, but they'd go on up to Germany or Switzerland or try to get to the UK and lodge an asylum claim there.
And Albanians would be sent back.
This is correct. At the time, it was possible, they felt, to distinguish between an Albanian and a Kosovo Albanian, in other words, somebody who belonged once in the former Yugoslavia.
So they were trying to define the word asylum, that yes. If you were from Kosovo, you had a legitimate reason to be fearful and risk persecution in your home country, as opposed to the Albanian, who presumably they saw as an economic refugee.
You've got it in one, yeah. But the point about that influx is that we in the EU were receiving large numbers of people, some of whom were clearly bona fide asylum seekers, and others who didn't actually want to lodge a claim for asylum because they thought that would hamper their progress. They'd rather kind of wing it and just get up into Western Europe as unauthorized migrants. Now, so the whole thing was amazing.
Now, the other image, because these are themes, in fact, there are themes which are going to be pursued in our second interview tonight, but we'll come back to that later. The other theme, the other picture is an extraordinary one in a Spanish enclave in Morocco, and you jumping over the fence to show how farcical a border actually was and is.
Yes. I mean, it's no mean feat to get over those fences, actually, and since then they've been reinforced.
So it's a bit harder now than it was in 1998.
Yeah, and actually at the time it was pretty hard. I mean, a border guard invited me to try and climb it, and I had a go. But, you know, I had 2 or 3 minutes to do it, whereas people who were coming in from Morocco, they had to take a run at it and try and get there get over it in a matter of seconds.
But even so, plenty did.
Plenty did, and the informal ruling was that once they'd got across it, they too would be processed, and many of those people would lodge claims for asylum.
I just want to create a picture of the paradoxes that come out of your writing. 11 million unauthorized migrants in the United States.
In the US, yep.
Two amnesties, effectively, one under Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, and in 1986 there was an amnesty under Reagan, and there's another one pending now. I mean, this is part of Obama's immigration reform bill, but it's running into trouble. And what really interests me about this is the business of the border, the way that we have the border in our national imagination. Because what's been going on since the late 1990s is, although the US, as you rightly say, is full of unauthorized migrants, the obsession has been with the fortification of the border with Mexico. And this obsession, there are a number of reasons
for
it.
A sort of migrant Maginot line.
It's a migrant Maginot line, but it's highly fortified. It's a high-tech Maginot line. And it is very, very defensive in its posture. I mean, Obama last year spent $12 billion on immigration control.
$12 billion.
Yeah, $12 billion. And actually the majority of that border security money went to the Mexican border. But it's fascinating, you know, because there's a kind of number crunching body called the Pew Center, which does a lot of research on demographics, and it has a Hispanic department. And the Pew Hispanic Center recorded that in the same year that Obama spent $12 billion, about 150,000 people crossed into the U.S., legal or illegal, across that border, and the same number left. So this massive fortification of the border, which I have to tell you includes, I don't know, drones, helicopters, 18,500 personnel.
And they still get through.
they still get through. And also, the other paradox is that how is it that you become an illegal migrant, an unauthorized migrant? It isn't actually very often by breaching physical borders. The way to become an illegal migrant is actually to get a visa and to overstay. The vast majority of unauthorized migrants in the European Union, the vast majority in the US, and the vast majority, so far as I know, in Australia,
indeed,
are visa overstayers. I mean, you've probably got...
They get off at Melbourne Airport or Sydney Airport and overstay.
Absolutely. You've got something in the order of 50,000 visa overstayers. These are illegal migrants. People who actually arrive on your shores to claim asylum cannot be regarded, by virtue of your signature of the convention, as illegal. They're not.
And there's another paradox. So you get an amnesty by Ronald Reagan, mm-hmm, and the economy improves because you increase your tax take.
This is exactly right. You know, if you have 11 million people who are off the books, you just aren't building up your tax revenue, are you? In fact, you see, in Arizona, the state of Arizona, which is right on the border...
Oh, this is another story. This is incredible.
There were probably something in the order of 500,000 unauthorized migrants, a key part of the economy, mostly in construction. They don't pay their taxes in the sense of revenue. But, you know, even if you look at unauthorized migrants resident in the US, they're paying their sales tax and a number of other contributions, including Social Security, which they may do on a forged document, but actually they'll never be able to claim benefit.
But didn't the Arizona economy take a dive when the governor took a tough line against migrants?
Well, it sure did. I mean, he pushed the illegal button, which was an odd thing to do because it's implicit and understood in the southern states of America that Mexican migrant labor or Latino migrant labor is crucial to the economy. This is a problem, whichever way you look at it. It's a political problem, and it's a problem of unfairness as well. Nonetheless, it exists.
I want to... sorry, go on.
And when the governor pushed this illegal button, all hell went loose in terms of the economy because the unauthorized workers thought that they'd better get out, and they started moving to other states where this legislation wasn't in force. And you're right, the economy took an immense dive.
So I want to come to the politics in a moment. Talk sure. to me about this melding of this belief that you have that there is really such a blurred line between the person who calls themselves the asylum seeker and the economic refugee, often coming from similar circumstances, and it's a rather artificial divide sometimes.
Well, I think if you take the broad picture of unauthorized migration, you could well argue, as I do in the book, that there are certain levels of incompetence in terms of government, certain levels of impoverishment and immiseration that actually constitute a threat to life, and that economic migrants who are fleeing that kind of destitution do have a very strong case, but they do not have this case under the terms of the Geneva Convention. And for better or worse, we have to distinguish them in principle from asylum seekers. It is not the same thing. It's my view, nonetheless, that the divide between the rich and the poor world, which we're always being told is going to narrow, that globalization will do the trick, that the neoliberal model is going to bring this about, and we must just tell people in the poorer South, the global South, sit tight, you know, the money's on its way. This model is giving rise to a kind of unfairness that means that... we're in a tricky position when we look at economic migrants who want to come in and don't have authorization. It's a tricky ethical position. I would distinguish it from asylum because people who are threatened in fear of their lives and persecution, they have a legal right to knock on our door and to enter by any means possible.
But nonetheless, you question perhaps not so much the convention as the UN resettlement program.
Well, I think the resettlement program is very honourable and interesting. And I have to say that Australia is one of the three countries, the other two being Canada and the US, that form the backbone of the UN's resettlement programme. The problem with resettlement is that it's not very big. I mean, in a typical year, 2009, Australia, Canada and the US handled about 90% of these resettled people that the UN offered. But actually, In 2011, 2 years later, and it's not that much different, it was about 62,000 people. Well, actually, there are 15 million refugees on the UNHCR's books. So it's one in every 160 refugees on that program, if you discount the 4.8 million Palestinians, which bring it down to 10 million globally. So Australia resettles about, I don't know, it also has the humanitarian, like, but yeah, about 20,000. And that is very, very admirable.
Down to 13,000 if we change government. You're listening to, I'm just reminding the audience what they're listening to before we continue our conversation, Jeremy. You're listening to Late Night Live here on RN with me, Norman Swan. And I'm talking to Jeremy Harding, the author of Border Vigils, Keeping Migrants Out of the Rich World, who's here in Australia at the Melbourne Writers Festival. But I mean, one might say plus ça change, because at the just before World War II, there were still 1.5 million Russians stateless as a result of the Russian Revolution.
Yeah, you're right. Upheavals like the Russian Revolution, upheavals like World War II, the kinds of upheavals that have been going on now in Afghanistan, the big moment in sub-Saharan Africa, where the liberation wars that were supposed to end in Angola and South Africa and Mozambique didn't end. These have produced enormous volumes of refugees. But to go back to the figures, I mean, and resettlement, which you raised earlier, it's quite interesting to get a sense of who the big receiving countries are for asylum seekers. The biggest one is Pakistan, which has 1.6 million refugees. And Pakistan is not a wealthy country, or at least parts of it are certainly not. So in a population of 180 million, the ratio is 1 to 112. Iran is another, a huge taker, 75 million population. It's got about 800,000 refugees, 1 to 85 human beings. Germany, a prosperous country, has really, you know, come up to the plate and taken a lot of refugees and asylum seekers, about 650,000, which is 1 to 125 non-refugees. Australia, population 23 million, admirable resettlement program. But the ratio of refugees to non-refugees here is about 1 to 460. I can't be the judge of what it is that goes on here, but I just wanted you to get a sense of perspective. So you've got on the one hand, 1 to 460. And in Pakistan, you've got 1 to 112.
What's the path to citizenship for those millions of refugees in countries like Iran and Pakistan, if indeed there is a path? Because citizenship is part of the story here.
It's certainly part of the story for unauthorized migration, economic migration. The path to citizenship for a refugee is to get refugee status. This is the thing. The real key is that the UN and the host country can determine that the asylum seeker has a status as a refugee, and then already one is in a far better position. I mean, the difficulty in a place like Indonesia, which is from which a lot of people, I gather, are coming to Australia, is that Indonesia is not a signatory to the UN Convention on the Status of Refugees. So even if the UN in Jakarta issues a determination and give somebody status as a refugee, this person can still run into trouble in Indonesia, can still be jailed or harassed, and this is a problem which doesn't exist in or shouldn't exist in other signatory states.
So let's move to the politics now and some of the interesting variations and also some of the things that might be going on in countries themselves. According to your writing, Canada and Australia are two countries that accept, with acceptance rates of refugee status, hugely higher than the UK. I mean, ours are upper 80 or 90% and Canada's as well. And UK is tiny.
Well, the UK is a strange story because the real volume of asylum seekers began to appear in the 1990s, the most recent. And this was largely because of the Balkans. But there was a wave of anxiety about asylum seekers coming into Britain, and the press handled it extremely badly. They were hostile to the point of offensiveness. The Dover Express famously described Kosovan refugees around Dover as human sewage. And it was wound up I'm afraid to say, by the British media, who aren't always at their best in dealing with asylum seekers. And this wave of asylum seekers coincided with a big uptake in migrants in general, because it was boom time, and the government realised that that the place should be open to migration. There was also a huge issue going on at the time, as there probably is in Australia, about the demographic. We were busy becoming an elderly population, and it became clear to us that without younger workers, and therefore migrant workers, we were not actually going to be able to keep up our commitment to pension systems and the like. So, really, to put it in shorthand, what happened is that I believe the government of the day traded off asylum against migration. It encouraged migration, and it went out of its way to try and close down asylum. And asylum figures, you're right, have dwindled. But it's also slightly as well to do with the, since then, with the diminution of the problem in Eastern Europe. I mean, the war...
Because asylum seekers, the numbers have dropped, actually.
Yeah, and the war in the Balkans is long gone. You know.
Why is it that you don't see in Europe, or indeed in Australia to a huge extent, asylum seekers or indeed refugees from sub-Saharan Africa?
You do actually see quite a lot of refugees from... I think there are quite a lot of Sudanese in
there are, it's in true, from both the Eritrean conflict, particularly
and
in
Eritrea
Melbourne.
As well, yep. There are a fair amount of sub-Saharan African asylum seekers in Europe, particularly in Italy, actually, and in France. But also, it's difficult to access Europe. And
so it's internal migration in the African continent.
It tends to be internal migration. I mean, in
South Africa.
Yeah, in the 80s, when I was covering the war in Eritrea, you used to go through Sudan and you would see immense camps. I mean, in the hundreds of thousands. And Sudan at that time had the biggest intake of refugees.
So
on the continent.
And this Jakarta Declaration talks about getting involved in the home countries to improve things. I mean, goodness knows what they think they're going to do. But, yeah. I mean, in Australia, we don't have, I could be really wrong, but we don't have migration pressure from Papua New Guinea. One explanation I've heard from that is that Papua New Guineans are actually quite happy in Papua New Guinea, even though it's poor and even though there's a lot of violence in the streets. It's not necessarily poverty that drives, the question then is it poverty that drives it or conflict?
I think that's such a good question. You see, I think on the matter of asylum, it's fear for one's life that drives it. And therefore, it doesn't always have a bearing on your wealth. I mean, classically, when regimes begin to persecute people, dictatorships above all, the first people who are rounded up tend to be the opposition, and the leaders of the opposition or the prominent figures of the opposition tend to be the professional classes. I'm thinking lawyers, doctors, journalists. Now, these aren't necessarily poor people. They have money. So that's the first thing about asylum. Never be deceived by whether an asylum seeker is wealthy or less wealthy. On the matter of economic migration, authorised or unauthorised, I think that the desperation that drives a lot of people from really shattered, badly managed economies is attended or balanced by an extraordinary sense of enterprise and adventure. In other words, what I'm trying to say about the economic migrant who comes up through Niger and walks...
They're pre-selected for their resilience.
They are almost pre-selected for resilience. And they'll be working their way across the Sahara, partly by truck, occasionally on foot.
They've almost qualified themselves as a migrant just by getting to the door.
Absolutely. Now, it can't just be desperation that drives this sort of person. I mean, there has to be an immense amount of adventure, resilience, curiosity, resolve. And in many ways, I mean, the European project is selecting for the very fittest and redoubtable kind of migrant.
So where does that leave the politicians? The arguments here by people who are often known for their liberal views, their humanitarian views, say, look, you cannot give up your migration policy to people smugglers. and we have to have a migration policy that benefits the country. And if we don't get tough on this, particularly the surge in boat migration, we're just allowing an illegal market, not the asylum seekers themselves, but the illegal market that creates the surge of boats to the country, is that our migration is being dominated by criminals.
I've got you. Yeah. I think the first thing to say about that is that it's a very, very small minority that comes by boat compared to the number of migrants who are actually accessing Australia. I mean, I think you've probably got, I'm guessing, something in the region of 100,000 to 200,000 a year coming in as migrants. The figure for people arriving by boat is far lower. I agree with you about the difficulty of...
But they are soaking up numbers that could be going to refugees who've applied through normal means, or they are, or in the total migration numbers of people who might be accepted as economic migrants.
Fair enough. Let's just for the moment keep the divide between asylum seekers and economic migrants. They are queue jumping, I've heard it said, the asylum seekers arriving by boat. The problem is that however well you try to order the arrangement of asylum seekers coming in, the world out there is unbelievably messy and people are not in control of the ways they get here. I believe that an asylum seeker who winds up in Jakarta probably thinks on his way or her way down there that actually the first thing they're going to do is get processed by UNHCR, the High Commissioner for Refugees in Jakarta. It's only subsequently that many of them, I'm not saying all of them, figure out that they're going to have to take a boat. So this comes as a shock. It's messy. The process is very slow. Indonesia is overstretched. It has problems of its own. And the net effect is that there are people who are willing to take asylum seekers across for a better stab at it. It may be unfair, but what's been going on in their lives to drive them down there in the first place is also deeply unfair. And my worry about trying to sort out good asylum seekers and bad asylum seekers and pinpoint those who arrive by boat as, in inverted commas, bad, is that really the danger is to perpetuate a description of them that's already been, they've already undergone in the country they left. I mean, the real danger
to challenge this, I mean, the politicians on both sides would say that they're actually trying to destroy the market for people smugglers and the death rate, the unacceptable death rate on the high seas in rickety boats.
Yeah, and I'd be very interested to know what this Jakarta proposal, what these 27 proposals are going to lead to, because actually all that's been identified, as far as I've seen from the news, is let's stop people smuggling. Well, you can't just stop people smuggling. You can't stop boats overnight without a strategy. So there has to be some kind of new thinking.
So what is that new thinking? I mean, you skirmish in your book with the idea of the redundancy of borders.
Yes.
So we get rid of border control?
No, we don't. But, there are many people who believe that's what's going to happen, but I don't think it is. I think that because of globalization, because of the general deregulation of markets and the immensity of the new trading arrangement that we have globally, borders are perversely becoming even more important in our imaginations than they were before there was so much movement of goods and capital across them. We're actually quite defensive now because we're not quite sure what all this globalization, the movement of money, the movement of goods, the movement of people has really left us. I think, and I'm not talking about Australia, I'm talking about Europe and the United States. We are highly defensive about the border. We are fortifying it beyond all reason. And I don't think frontiers are going to go away. So what to do? Well, I'm a journalist. I'm not a kind of policy. I'm not a policy one.
Yeah, but you've been throwing these grenades out from behind the barricades.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay. Well, I think in this case, if you're spending $2 billion Australian dollars a year on offshore immigration management, the thing to do is to think of how it might be differently spent. And to go back to Jakarta, really, it might be an idea to try and find ways to invest in the infrastructure that could contain and help to process asylum seekers in Jakarta, give them some kind of facilities in line with the government, with the consent of the government of Indonesia, obviously, that would allow them to stay there while determinations were made. And I think that in the end, this might have the effect of reducing access by boat, but you will never stop it. I mean, can I just give you an example in parallel? When the border was being fortified between Arizona and Mexico, it was decided to leave out a whole stretch. They needn't fortify it because the desert was just so uncrossable that it could be left to itself. Actually, once the adjacent parts were fortified, people started coming through the desert and the death rate started to rise, and within 4 or 5 years there were 1,700 people dead in the desert, because when people want to move, they move, and whatever it is you do, it's going to be very, very difficult to stop them.
And political leadership perhaps on this issue is in short supply globally.
It's certainly in short supply in the EU. In the US, well, Obama is trying to put through another amnesty deal to get 11 million people on the books. But the quid pro quo for that is that he has to spend maybe another $16 billion on that border, because the people who oppose the amnesty are not even going to look at that bill.
Until there's a trade-off.
Republicans in the Senate. It's a trade-off.
Jeremy, thank you very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you very much, Norman.
Jeremy Harding's newly updated work on immigration is in the form of a book called Border Vigils, Keeping Migrants Out of the Rich World. It's published by Verso. And Jeremy's here as a guest of the Melbourne Writers Festival, and he's doing various sessions for them, some about the London Review of Books, where he's a contributing editor. But on Sunday, he'll be giving a talk on migration. It's at 5:30 in the evening at Deakin Edge at Melbourne's Federation Square. I'm Norman Swan, sitting in for Philip Adams. Next on Late Night Live, women, sexuality and militant Islamism.